There will be spoilers. There will be edits that make us sound way more professional than the reality.
Magic of editing. We can sound like we know what we're doing.
All right, so where's my books?
I'm going to cut that from here and put it right back at the beginning through the magic of editing. Right after spoilers.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, you there?
Who? What? When? All right, fine, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. All right, welcome to, I guess, the first episode of A Legion of Three.
It feels like the second episode in some ways, but it is the first episode.
It's awesome. The first second episode. Or is it the second first episode?
Time has really become meaningless.
We're not really good with math.
No. Accounting. Arithmetic.
So we're here. We're going to talk about an old short story called Distant Echoes of Old Night.
I feel like there should be some heroic music there or something.
We're not very heroic.
No, and we're not really good at music either. You're lucky we have sound at all, people.
Yep. Story is written by Rob Sanders.
And this is from 2013, I think? This is pretty old as far as heresy stuff goes.
It is. As part of my looking into this story, I found a reference in Black Library's description that it's basically the very first reference that we ever get to destroyers, which I guess was a new unit that they invented or they had talked about and knew about, but then didn't have rules for until after this came out.
All right. Should we start at the beginning?
Still aren't as good as the story is.
No, they've gotten better. So they came out in, I think it was book 3 or 4, and then they made it into the Red Books, and then they've now been FAQ'd in from the 2019 FAQ, I think this is? 2018, 2019? You know, time is very, very meaningless at this point. And they've gotten a lot better. They've come down in price significantly, which is important. And they have some cool stuff to reflect their unique rites of war that they practice. But we'll come back to that in a bit. Let's talk about the story first.
All right. So Distant Echoes of Old Night. It makes a reference to Old Night. And that is a time period in the 30K and 40K universe that describes the time between this awful cataclysm that separated the entire universe and the time period when the Emperor then started the unification of the galaxy again.
And Old Night was, I mean, we don't know exactly what it was, but we know it was probably a series of different cataclysms, and one of the cataclysms we know about was thinking machines. Iron Men.
Abominable intelligences, yeah.
Right.
So, like the Terminator, Skynet, and all humanity needs to die.
Well, you know, you build a machine and then you tell the machine to make the universe a better place and humanity might not be in that better place.
Yeah, I think it came to the realization that all humanity sucks.
Got a point.
They're just going to kill themselves anyways.
That's right. Yeah. And certainly from later future history, boy, that makes some trouble to figure that out. You know, maybe they weren't wrong. So, all right. But the echoes, and again, we should say at the start of our episodes, there will be spoilers. There will be so many spoilers.
Here be spoilers.
So the echoes from the story are, let's use some weapons that we haven't gotten to pull out in a long time.
So during this story, it takes place primarily on a moon called Algonquis.
Yep.
And it
used to be pretty.
It used to be pretty. It used to be a forest moon that made some very hard, what they call ferrous wood. So like ironwood, I guess, is what they're going for there. That used to be harvested and shipped out all across the Imperium. But now it is a, what would you call it? Like a swamp Rotting cesspool. And the reason for that is because the Death Guard have showed up and decided to wipe the place out.
And the worst part about it is that they've basically been going around. This is so early on in the heresy. The Death Guard are basically unleashed by Horus to go cause a ruckus. And they're causing a ruckus by basically viral bombing, bacteria unleashing, dropping hell on worlds, just indiscriminately. They go around and they just absolutely devastate things. And it's kind of like they've wanted to do this for a long time, and now it's exciting. This is pre-Nurgle. This is just them being jerks.
Nice.
Thank you. I do try.
So during the early parts of the story, you find out that the Death Guard showed up in this system and they were basically picking and choosing which worlds died and how. And apparently Forgal, who is the leader of the Death Guard, I guess this particular group.
It's funny because they talk about it's from a frigate. That's a really small ship. I mean, this is not like a battle barge. Frigates are tiny in the grand scheme of 40K, 30K ships.
Yeah, it was Mortet Forgal, Vitus Forgal, and he's in command of the Barbarossa's Sting.
Yeah, I didn't find any other reference to the Barbarossa's Sting anywhere, so I don't know if that makes an appearance later on, or if it will it eventually come back in, or if it's already come back in and I just didn't find the reference. I don't know.
Again, it's a small ship. I mean, there's probably thousands of them.
Right. So the one thing that I took out of this was that they weren't exterminating the worlds as they went along. They were just wounding them, grievously wounding the worlds and ruining them for the Imperium. So it's kind of a scorched earth policy, but not quite. I think it was more along the lines of wound them grievously so that they call out for help and then kind of leave them a ripe target, because if the Imperium sends forces to try and help them, then they're going to get caught later on by the traitor forces, and it weakens the overall Imperium.
And so if they did that, snipers used to do that. They would wound a man and then let, you know, his squad mates come try to save him, and then they could pick out the whole squad. That they called that something. Do you remember what that is, John? Besides just cruel.
Yeah, I mean, it's tactically it makes sense, but that's something the Alpha Legion does.
Yeah,
no doubt. It's called shooting sitting ducks.
Well, I mean, but the idea is that you leave bait. You put down a man, not kill him. You could have killed him, but you leave him to be rescued, and then when the rescuers come, you kill them. And then you kill the original guy, too.
Right.
So, yes, that's kind of what they're doing here. But they're also having a good time. I mean, they're clearly not doing this in a businesslike fashion. It says, atmospheric contaminants, galactic plagues, long thought eradicated. This is them, you know, basically planting a garden of filth.
Yeah.
Creating new life through the decay of other life.
Right.
So what has happened so far in the story is the Death Guard came into the system. They were trashing worlds. An Imperial Fist frigate had the misfortune of tripping through this system and basically got obliterated by the Death Guard in their frigate, the Barbarossa Sting. And so the pieces of that frigate have landed on this moon, and we basically see most of the story through one character. So you want to touch on who that character is?
Glenn, you got it?
Sure. Brother Chaplain Morgax Moron.
Is that how we're saying
it?
Murnau,
I think. Murnau.
Murnau. So he's been tasked with going and killing all the survivors, basically. And he's standing there with his Vox caster in the knee-deep murk. And he's doing his best villain monologue. We're Death Guard. We're going to destroy you because we're better. And I just, you know, kept thinking of all the, you know, bad guys who sit there and they sort of monologue with their, you know, how they're gonna, you know, rule the world, why they're better. It's like, now it makes me hate the Death Guard so much more.
They do make good villains. I mean, they are not, so far there's not a lot of sympathetic Death Guard. The Death Guard seem, you know, very driven and very, you know, loyal to Mortarion, and whatever he says, you know, they basically, if he wanted to go walking across hot coals, they would lay down in front of his feet. So you don't really feel like there are many heroes in the Death Guard. You can kind of make the argument. Obviously, Garrow came from the Death Guard. He's pretty heroic. What's the Herald of Nurgle's name?
Typhus.
He kind of had some heroism to him. There's a couple of small scenes with him before he's infested, obviously, where you kind of see that Mortarion kind of just dumps on him and is a jerk. Mortarion never comes across as very, you know, relatable. He's always just sort of sad, bitter, angry, blames everybody for what's happened to him. And his legion reflects that. You know, they are sad, bitter, angry jerks, too. Not like the Iron Warriors, who are cool, bitter, and angry.
Well, they have a reason. On that. They have a reason to be bitter and angry.
It's true. Yeah. And the Death Guard do, too, but they weren't treated as poorly as the Iron Warriors, and that's a story for another episode.
So rewinding just a little bit, the name of the Imperial Fist frigate is Xanthus, X-A-N-T-H-U-S. And I had to look that up to see what that was. And Rob Sanders, you know, God bless him. It apparently means yellow or gold. So
golden haired.
Blonde. What a great name for a Imperial Fist ship. He went into and looked up other words for yellow or gold or blonde and landed on Xanthus. And he's like, that's perfect. All right. So
they're kind of ochre.
Yeah. So the other thing that I picked up on my second reading on this through was this is a chaplain. Now, weren't chaplains new to the legions at this point? Because only recently they had the Librarius, and weren't the chaplains created in a pair with the Librarius?
I'm not sure. I know that I feel like chaplains were not every, just like the Librarius, not every legion had them. Obviously, the more fervent legions like your Word Bearers and obviously your Death Guard did, their role is very different in 40K than it was in 30K. 30K, you know, they were basically hype men, you know, to get guys up or whatever. They're not faith-based, but they are kind of like, you know, this is the history of our legion, and this is why you will go out and do me honor today kind of stuff. More than, you know, whip them up into a religious frenzy like, again, 40K chaplains.
See, I was always under the impression that the chaplains were created at the same time as the Librarius, and the chaplain's job was to make sure that the Librarius stayed on the path of the straight and narrow, and basically the chaplain was there to put the librarian down if the librarian got out of hand.
And I feel like there is a legion where that was a factor, but I don't remember what story that was. I think you have something going on there, that there literally was. I think it might be the Imperial Fists, that the chaplains were kind of purity testers to make sure that you weren't screwing around.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but
I don't think it's true for all the legions. Just like everything else, every legion is much more unique in their operation in 30K, and you know, because obviously there are no chaplains in the Space Wolves. But the Rune Priests have a lot of that in them. You know, they certainly do whip their guys up.
Right. And like a Blood Angel chaplain, you know, looks for the guys that are falling to the Black Rage.
Right. Right.
So
why don't you come with me?
But that's later.
Let's go over here and repaint your armor. But okay, moving on.
If you haven't gotten that far in the Heresy stories, spoilers.
Yeah.
So at the beginning, we find this chaplain, and he's basically standing over the sinking ship that has been, you know, heavily devastated by Barbarous's sting, but the remnants of it are sinking into the swamp that is basically being kind of tainted as they go along. The swamp it started out as, you know, fresh water and is now muck and filth and grossness. And he's shouting at them through a boxcaster, taunting them as they die, basically. He's basically telling the Fists, you know, the reason why this happened to you is because you screwed with us. And we always win. With the Death Guard are better than you and whatever else. And it's kind of like, again, he's being a monologuing villain. And what a jerk that he knows that many of these people have, you know, horribly suffered because these ships don't fall into the atmosphere very well. That's not what they're intended for. But the ones who do survive, he's taunting on the way down.
Yeah. So we've got the pieces of the ship are sinking into these below the surface of the swamp. There's a line in here that I was going to ask you guys about. He says, Forgall had dispatched the chaplain to the crash site. His orders had been unequivocal. There were to be no survivors. Murnau, the Mortat rasp across the voice, Fenestra still hasn't deciphered the astrotelepathic partial transmitted from the Xanthus. And then he says, that's disappointing. We should have that bolt magnet freak skinned alive. It disgusts me that we have to rely on such degenerate humanity for our long-range communications. So that quote, he basically, he doesn't like the astrotelepathica.
So the Death Guard in general hate psychics. They are hugely against psychics. which makes later occurrences more interesting, I think. But they were, you know, they were the loudest voice at Nicaea to shut down the Librarius.
The Death Guard.
Yes.
Or Mortarian.
Mortarian specifically, but the Death Guard in general have always been anti-Psyker. They think they're just another form of Xenos filth. Hmm. So it's not surprising. And again, they don't have a choice. They have to have Astropaths and they have to have Navigators, or they don't communicate and they don't go sailing through the warp, at least not until Papa Nurgle, you know, gives them some extra blessings. But in the meantime, they're forced to work with things that they abhor.
Right.
It's just extra. It's extra interesting to see. It's like they set up so many things that later Death Guard are very different from. It shows you how far that they fall, because like the World Eaters don't really fall that far. They've always been kind of lunatics. And now they just, you know, scream corn instead of for the Emperor and for Angron. The Death Guard changed so much over their course of loyalist to traitor to chaos.
But they're implacable and immovable. I don't understand.
Sure. And bloated and disgusting. But again, later.
Nice. So we find out just a little bit more about the story right after that, where they talk about where the message was sent and where the ship was likely going. They say that the destination was likely to be the Sol system. So according to the frigate's last recorded trajectory, that they think it was heading towards Sol. So they start having a discussion as to what possibly the ship was carrying, whether it was intelligence, some sort of material, or some sort of supplies, bringing information back to Dorne or something. And they have a little mini conversation as to whether or not they should try and investigate whether or what it was on the ship and maybe retrieve it and take it back to the Warmaster.
Right.
Or not. And I don't understand why Forgall said no, but there's a line in there. Do you know where I'm talking about there, Glenn? Or do you have that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Forgall had said no. There's no subterfuge. They're not the 20th Legion.
Right.
Yeah. That.
All right. Sidebar here. The reason why he made Glenn say that is because Glenn plays Alpha Legion.
Right.
Just to be clear. Best. Yeah. Well, there's something. I also find it really funny that as much as Murnau kind of defers to Forgall, he also kind of disses him a little bit. He says, you know, he always sees things from the command floor of the ship, meaning he doesn't come down and get his hands dirty the way that Murnau does.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really subtle, but it's like, I see. You're going to let me take care of this. And because later, you know, we learn that Forgall is rushing off to go chase down more targets and leaves again this dirty work to Murnau. Yeah, literally dirty work.
More likely leaving him, period.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he does say he'll
Murnau
be back.
Murnau came down on Murnau, and we'll see his troops with him, came down in drop pods. They didn't even, you know, come with the rest of the ship.
Yeah. They didn't come down with a Thunderhawk or one of the other flyers that would allow them to fly back. It was a one-way trip. Nice. According to Forgall, he says, no survivors, Morgax. Do you hear me? The chaplain responds, it will be done. And then Forgall responds, the barbarous' sting will return for you shortly, Forgall said. Then the tedium of the warp and on to the fabricator moons of Uniflex Minora. Finish it and make it quick. So they're hoping that this is going to be a quick in and out. Just go in, find the survivors, kill them, and be ready for pickup.
After all, they're just Imperial Fists. I mean, you're Death Guard. What do you care?
All right. So then what happens?
So then Murnau decides he's going to go take care of this. He's going to, you know, personally attest to there are no survivors. And we go and meet his troops. And it's actually interesting because they talk about it being one squad. This is how dismissive they are. This is the remnants of a frigate that was shot out of space. I mean, granted, that it can't have a whole lot of defenders, but they drop one character and one squad to finish it off. Now, the squad happens to be the Destroyer Squad.
The Graven. Gorfon's Destroyer Squad, known as the Graven.
Glenn, tell us about the Graven.
Okay, so the Graven are led by Sergeant Grohl Gorfon. They are basically the worst of the Astartes. So the Legion officers had to keep a tight leash on them because they were just you know, they make regular Astartes look like fluffy bunnies for how menacing and killy they are.
It sounds like all of them could have been perfectly fine if they were Night Lords, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. They're willfully destructive. There's no quarter. For them, the galaxy must burn.
Nice.
And so all of these guys are already in rough shape because they play around with destructive weapons like rad weapons, which are as dangerous for the wielder as they are for the target, or at least almost.
Yeah, the line in the story is, these were Terran-devised nightmares, terror weapons of Gene War darkness of old night. With material harvested from decommissioned fusion reactors, the warheads were so radioactive that it was a wonder that Zorak didn't glow in the dark. Instead, he and his comrades bore the horrible cost of handling such hideous weaponry in the burns and scarring afflicting their battle-bred forms. So, I know in one of the other references to destroyers that a lot of them tend to paint their armor black because of the scorching. They can't keep their Legion colors on their armor, so they just paint it black to cover up some of the scorch marks that they're going to get from all the, you know, the heat of the rad weaponry and things that they're going to get on them.
Yeah, it's better than being factory gray. They just go for black. And it makes sense. I mean, they are the blackest of the Marines. They are jerks.
Mm. They do make a reference to one of the guys in this squad. Just, he doesn't even have painted armor. His armor is gray. And he sees the one guy and he's, you know, his armor is completely gray, except it's covered in enough muck that it's basically camouflaged at this point. So
yeah, well, most of the Death Guard are that way anyways, with the exception of the green trim. So this guy probably doesn't bother. That squad probably doesn't even bother putting the green trim on it.
It's just,
yeah, they're not big on like heraldry in general.
Or ornamentation or, yeah. The destroyer icon, that's the one that looks like the biohazard symbol, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so we've got, what's his face? The chaplain. There's going to be some editing here.
Murnau. Murnau. He comes upon the ship, and he's kind of curious as to why they haven't, you know, gone in yet. And they learn that basically the survivors, mostly the serfs, the human crew of the ship, have got a pretty good defense set up. And the destroyers are literally bombarding it with rad missiles and rad grenades and heavy bolt pistols. They keep talking about the bolt pistols like they're special. In the rules, they're just bolt pistols, but they talk of them about, like, you know, big, chunky bolters.
They also say drum-fed bolt pistols,
yeah,
which gives you an idea of the how trigger-happy they are.
Yes. But there's 10 of them versus however many survivors are left. But the survivors are, their Imperial Fists, or at least their Imperial Fist servants. They know a little bit about defending a spot. So it's kind of an interesting, even fight until the Death Guard get a little bit more creative.
Yeah, the crew of the Xanthus get a plasma cannon to somehow operate, and they fire it. Murnau saw that it was aimed high, so he and most of the squad were able to kneel underneath of it, just take, you know,
Heat burns,
and their, you know, auto senses all click out. But they did lose one destroyer to it. So now they're down. Down a guy. But they lose two more to just the Imperial Fists and the other defender. So now they're three down out of, what, 10 or 20?
I think it's only 10. I mean, I really... They give names for most of the squad. And then you can sort of watch them get ticked off as they're killed boarding. Oh, spoiler warning. There's going to be a boarding.
Oh. Is there?
Yeah, so... The thing is Murnau doesn't want to just let it slip into the water and assume that the fists die. He basically wants to count the dead with his hands.
Those are his orders. He has to make sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And
any other Legion would have been
orders.
Like, they're going to die. They're going to suffocate. You know, that's not going to end well for anybody. But Death Guard, take it a little bit more seriously. We're going in.
This is a testament to an Astartes following orders.
Well, and also just being so unbending, you know, these guys are doomed. They're not going to survive this. You shot them out of space, but they are going to make sure the job is done personally. And here we go.
So how do they eventually wind up breaching the wreckage of the ship? How do they get past the overlapping fields of fire and the welded bulkheads that the Imperial Fists laid in preparation to stop them from boarding? How do they do that?
Glenn, you take.
Destroyers assault and board the Xanthus through an access they created themselves.
Make a hole.
Yep.
With a tree.
With a tree and climb up the tree to get through the hole.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting kind of low-tech way that they burst into the ship. They basically, with a power fist, chop down a tree. The tree falls, crashes into a ship, makes a hole, and then they climb up the tree, the fallen tree. It's, you know, I assume it's like a 45-degree angle, and dive in.
Yeah.
I was picturing like a giant redwood, you know.
Yeah.
It would almost have to be able to fall and be tall enough and long enough and wide enough for a Space Marine squad, an entire squad, to run up and then jump into the wreckage. So,
yeah, it says it's a rotting trunk of petrified ferris wood, and it takes him several thwacks with his power fist, so it's not insignificant. I mean, this is clearly a tree that can take some abuse, because power fists, while not exactly the lumberjack tool of choice, are tough. I mean, they will punch through a land raider, so yeah. This is a big deal.
Knocking giant chunks out of the tree to knock it down.
Yeah.
So.
And again, that's just creative use for power fists.
Yeah. Rewinding for a quick second, before they go up there, Murnau tells Gorfon that they've been ordered to step up the schedule and they must end the fists. And he said, "We don't have long before extraction." I mean, Forgul just left with.
Yeah.
To go to another system. I don't think he's be back in 15, 20 minutes. You know.
Well, you know, Murnau's got things to do. He's got a date later.
I don't think it was another system. I think it was ships arrived in that same system they were in. He was just going to go over to the area where they were, take care of them, and then come back so they could all leave.
But Glenn's right. It's still not going to be 10 minutes. There's going to be a little bit more time. But at the same time, I guess, you know, they do have a plasma cannon on the ship now. They have killed one destroyer. It is possible that this fight is going to go poorly if they don't get into a boarding, because destroyers are better up close, frankly.
Yeah.
So when Forgul tells them that they're leaving, they're breaking orbit, and he says long-range auger scans have revealed a victim flotilla entering the neighboring system.
Yeah. Neighboring system. Okay. There you go.
That's not in the same area. It's in a whole other system.
Right.
And you can't even make warp until you're out of that system.
Right.
Well, you can't make warp safely. But if you don't care what happens,
well,
what are they? Yeah.
They're not suicidal. That's the one thing about the Death Guard. They're willing to do insane things, but they're not exactly falling on their swords. I mean, the world eaters are more suicidal, in my mind, than the Death Guard. The Death Guard are just driven. Well, they care a lot.
Their obedience.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, they're willing to do anything it takes to get the job done. And we'll see that in just a minute. So they come on board and then we talked about this. John and I had a game a long time ago. Where we actually talked about this story. So you actually have to think about the fact that this ship is canted at, let's say, a 45-degree angle, but maybe it's sharper than that. We don't know. You come in at the very top of the ship at some angle, and are fighting your way down ship as this ship is sinking into the muck and the water. So instead of it being a normal boarding action, which is, you know, on a flat plane, they're sort of sliding downward, and as they go, the resistance intensifies. So it's really cool and cinematic to think about the fact that they have to, A, balance themselves and not go falling down as they're fighting their way through, but also that gravity is on their side, because if they were to, say, roll grenades or something down, it's much harder for the enemy to throw them back upward.
You're right. It's very cinematic. I didn't imagine it being quite so steep in the beginning, and then towards the end, as they describe more and more water flooding in, that it, you know, almost like the end of that awful movie Titanic, you know, as you watch the ship itself, you know, slowly raising up out of the water and sliding in. So
they say somewhere that it's, you know, slowly turning from being level to further and further up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The front is down and the back end is up. They don't really give you an exact measurement, I guess, what the degree of angle is. But I have a vision that it is becoming steeper and steeper. And towards the end, when they are starting to really go down, it becomes really steep. It becomes 90 degrees.
Yeah.
But it just, to me, that is such a cool vision that they've got to fight downward into the abyss, basically. And literally, they're fighting their way down as the water is coming up. So they're sort of diving into death.
Yeah, just descending into the underworld.
Yes. That's a Death Guard thing to do.
All right. So as they make entry, the destroyer squad goes first and guns blazing, and the chaplain follows along behind. As he goes in, he sees, you know, the remnants of the loyalist crew, not the Space Marines yet, not the Imperial Fists, but he does see the, you know, the bondsmen and whatnot that were attached to the Imperial Fists and part of the ship. And he proceeds further on, and he finds the very first casualty among the destroyers inside the breach. And I thought this was a really interesting scene. He comes across a Space Marine that's missing half his head, still alive, trying to reload his bolt pistol, but obviously gonna die.
And not doing a good job of reloading the bolt pistol. His faculties have been lost.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. So, yeah, he finds Kurgle, and he finds him laying on his side. He says his helm was shattered, and only half the destroyer's head remained within it. Lying on his side, his lifeblood cascading down through a grill landing, Kurgle blinked in comprehension at Murnau. He endlessly repeated his attempt to attach a fresh drum magazine to his empty pistol, failing again and again.
This reminds me of like a robot. This is almost like an automaton, like, again, from the movie Terminator, where it just doesn't give up. It can't do it anymore, but that's not stopping it from trying.
Yeah.
Driven.
Nice. When I read that, it reminded me of there was a reference somewhere of a Space Marine basically losing his head, and his body kept taking, you know, like five or six more steps before it finally fell down, because, you know, that the body just didn't stop. So,
the legs got the message before. So, you know,
yeah,
they were just waiting for further commands that weren't coming.
We'll just keep it up. So the chaplain puts that destroyer down using his Crozius and continues on, trying to find the rest of the Graven, and ventures further and further into the ship after the sound of bolter fire. So he knows that they have actually made contact with the Imperial Fists at that point. Once he gets there, what does he find?
He finds the Graven altogether on a steep incline of a maintenance corridor. He was surprised to see the destroyer's advance had stopped. Gorfon reported three or four Fists are below holding the gunnery deck, and they are fortified and well armed with ammo. Meanwhile, the destroyers only have, they're like on their last clips. Gorfon informs Murnau that the Fists will present themselves shortly.
Why would they do that?
Right. but right before that, though, Murnau finds Lathams, the captain of the Imperial Fists, that he was monologuing at. They find the captain of the Fists dead in the corridor.
So all that taunting was for nothing.
Yeah.
Very upsetting.
So Murnau's now wondering who's leading the resistance.
So they're wondering if it's just another legionary or a sergeant or somebody else.
Right.
But they don't know. So why does he think that they're gonna give themselves up shortly?
So he then looks over, and Gorfon is sort of smirking a little bit, and he's throws him, kind of, I assume, very gently, a bomb canister, which Murnau realizes is full of Phosvex. And it's the third canister, the one he hasn't thrown yet. There's already two cooking off down below, making life very unhappy for everybody in its vicinity.
So Phosvex was something, I think this was the first reference to it that I ever saw. I don't know if it's the first reference in the stories, but I think this was the first one I ever saw. And when with a name like Phosvex, you're like, oh, well, it's phosphorus. It's, you know, it's a white phosphorus round. No, it's not like that. From their description to me, it seems like phosphorus, white phosphorus mixed with napalm and evil and mean.
Yes. And it's got some high rads. It's got some jelly. It's a gas, but if it touches you, it basically turns to jelly, and then that jelly is made of acid. It just eats everything. It eats flesh, it eats armor, it eats tanks, it eats ground, it eats air. I mean, it is the nastiest stuff in a non-nuclear form in all of 30K. I don't think we've seen anything more just completely destructive and disgusting.
The only thing that I can think of that's worse is the Life Eater virus.
Yeah, the virus bomb.
Well, but that doesn't kill tanks. It just kills light. I mean, it kills anything organic. This stuff, it does not discriminate. This stuff will kill anything. Destroy, render into smaller atoms, period.
I think somewhere it basically said that it would burn even in a vacuum for a short while.
It'll burn underwater. Yeah, I mean, it's like Greek fire with acid and radiation and napalm. I mean, you're right. It is just a nightmare in a canister. But there's one drawback here, because Murnau is sort of surprised. He's like, you've been using this? And Gorfon says, well, yes, I've thrown two of them down there. You missed the screams, Chaplain. And Murnau says, that's unfortunate. I wish you hadn't done that. Why? And this is where I said this to Glenn. There's this oh shit moment on the part of Griffon. Because the Chaplain says, we have to go down there and make sure they're all dead. And Griffon is like, what? You got to be crazy. We're not going down. You know, literally, he knows how nasty this stuff is. This is clearly not his first experience throwing Phosphex on someone, but it's his first experience in trying to walk through it.
You can't be serious. That would be suicide, the Death Guard destroyer protested.
And then a destroyer saying it's suicide. That's a big deal.
Murnau leant in close. Each of his words was hushed and deliberate. No survivors. But Brother Chaplain, Gorfon began, the Phosphex will test us. Yes, Murnau admitted, but no more than Lord Mortarion was tested, advancing undaunted, indomitable, into the mountains of Barbarus. That makes a reference to Mortarion, I think, trying to take out his adoptive father.
Who was like up a mountain of death. No air, just poison stuff.
On Barbarus.
On Barbarus, yeah.
A homeworld which he fell on.
Yep. Nasty, so. Nasty place. Made for a fun guy.
Nice.
So, we've decided that we're going down there to make sure that they're all dead, even though this stuff is going to make them all dead, and we've got to pass through it to get to them. All right, that sounds like a good plan.
And what it's worth, he takes off his helmet to go in. It's like, really?
So, the two of them start walking and order the squad to start heading into the fire.
Fall in.
And they do. It's like...
he detects a moment's hesitation, which, and again, these are the nastiest of the nasty, and they know what they're getting themselves into. I mean, there's no surprise here. They know how nasty Phosphex is, but yeah, they have their orders, and they'll do it. They didn't complain. He just was like making sure that the Chaplain knew what he knew.
Right. So you mentioned that they took off their helmets to go in, and the only thing that I can think of for that is the fact that it's possible that their helmet's auto senses would block out them being able to see.
Yeah, it's possible because the auto senses work somewhat, we know, on the infrared scale. And right now, if everything is glowing hot,
right,
you can't really make stuff out.
So they take off their helmets as a way to be able to see something as they advance in. So they advance down through the fire. And when they get inside of the fire or in a little bit further into the area that they're in, they actually do find some Imperial Fists still alive, at least one, and they put him down pretty quickly.
Yeah, and they don't fire back either. They're not in any shape to be able to do anything.
Oh, they're melting.
They're basically fish out of water just gasping for something.
I think they described the one guy as having no skin left on his head.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, just exposed muscle and bone at that point.
Yep.
So not a good play to be. So they find bodies. They find the one Imperial Fist dying. And then they find a blood trail.
He was wearing bear gray armor. He was the precious cargo. At least that's what Murgul thought. And so the guy's name is Varshjold.
So I don't know. I mean, they don't really go into detail here. This is where we're going to speculate some. That's very much a Space Wolf name, right?
Let's read the description that they say. Hold, Murnau barked through his scorched lips. The prone warrior was certainly not an Imperial Fist, as the plain color of his plate confirmed. His armor could almost be taken for that of the Death Guard. Murnau squinted with his raw eyes. Even through the flickering phosphorescence dancing across the plate, it was clear that the suit bore no marking, legion symbol, or rank insignia. Who is he? Gorfon managed, expecting the chaplain to know. Murnau didn't, but he felt sure that this was the precious cargo that the Xanthus was transporting to Terra. The passenger was a space marine, true, but a legionary no more. He is a loyalist spy, the chaplain announced, some agent of the Emperor. The chaplain stepped in front of the crawling space marine, who looked up at him from the deck. His eyes were misted and blood-speckled, and his face flesh ruptured and wasting away before the chaplain's gaze. His russet hair and beard were plated, and his chin whiskers rich with the clotted gore he'd brought up from his disintegrating lungs. As he stared up at Murnau, he showed the blood-stained serration of sharpened teeth. His voice, when it graced the seething silence, was raw but full of primal determination. This is Varshgold, the agent wheezed. Sergeant, do it now.
All right, so signs point to him being a space wolf. He's got serrated, sharpened teeth. Space wolves, their gray kind of brown armor, I guess, could kind of be the Death Guard were more greenish gray, but there's similarities there. He's got no markings. He's got russet hair and beard. It doesn't really go into super detail on that. The name certainly sounds Fenrisian. What's his story? Why does he have no markings? Why is he no longer a legionary? Or were they just trying to hide something?
Well, more likely he's a member of Malkador's Knights Errant.
But this is long before that.
Is it?
Well, from the writing standpoint, I don't think the Garrow story started until later. Yes, the seeds could have been planted before about the Knights Errant stuff. I don't think anything with Garrow had been printed when this was printed. I'm not 100% on that. I will defer to anybody who wants to check it. But also, we never hear about him. They have talked about the various Knights Errant because Garrow recruits all of them himself.
Well, hold on. Maybe this guy was the first Knights Errant.
Precursor.
Yeah. Who gets killed, and then Garrow is the second first. We're on that again.
But all right, if that's true, a space wolf working for Malkador, space wolves don't love covert operations. That's not really their thing. Granted, this guy might be different.
Maybe that's why it didn't work.
Yeah, you picked the wrong guy to be stealthy. That's what happened here. You really screwed that one up.
So another possibility, early on, Leman Russ sent squads to watch all the other Primarchs at Malkador's order, and it's possible
them, and then if they turn rogue, put them down.
Right. It's possible that this guy is a remnant of one of those squads, and it's possible that his armor was somehow damaged, and so they basically just equipped him with brand new armor that was not marked.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be, but we don't know. And
this was probably too early in the heresy for that to have taken place yet.
Yeah, I mean, the Death Guard go on their early rampage right after Istvan V. They really are before. So they basically go out and do this. I can't think of the name of the campaign, but they're doing this is early on. And then they come back and join the War Master's forces on the march to Earth later. And I would imagine that when that happened, that the bodyguard / execution squads came much later after Kalth too, because this was happening kind of concurrent with Kalth, at least from the information that we have about when the story takes place. I don't know. It's not clear. And unfortunately, we don't learn a lot about Varshgold because he doesn't last long on the page.
The reference that I can see to that is the poison ships The origins of the plague fleets can be found in the bygone era of the Horus Heresy. I don't know if that's what you're looking for, Rob.
What do you mean? Did it,
the campaign, the name of the campaign.
No, I'll have to. I'll dig into the black books. I'm not going to do it right now because it may take too long. It's just it was very early after Istvan V. It was basically the Death Guard are unleashed. So you have it's not that important. You know, it's funny because you basically have the legions split up for a while. The War Leaders go and join the Word Bearers in tearing their way through Ultramar. And that's called the Something Crusade, right? That's a Shadow Crusade? No, might be. Anyway, you have the different the traitors basically all kind of scatter around and just wreak havoc. You know, they've already taken out three legions, and then they're trying to disrupt the Ultramarines. Obviously, Kalth did a really good job of that. Cool. They try to stop the Dark Angels. That's a Thrahmas Crusade.
That's Night Lords tie up the Dark Angels. The Alpha Legion ties up the White Scars.
Right. At Chondax.
Yep.
But we're scattering a little bit. So, and then the Space Wolves, who messes with them? I know they go after, well, I guess they're actually pretty tore up going after Magnus.
They get sicked on the Thousand Suns, and then after that, they get tied up by the Alpha Legion.
Alpha Legion.
Yeah. Okay. So. Anyway, this is very early on, and we don't know who this guy is. There's really not a clear sign. And I don't know that this ever comes up again. I don't know that his name, John, you check into that.
Yeah, we checked into it. I couldn't find anything.
Okay.
I didn't
He's a mystery.
This is kind of a dead end as far as heresy goes.
Literally.
There's no other reference to the ship. There's no other reference to any of the named characters that I could find. So
it was all they could sell destroyers.
Except that. All right, so let's go forward. What happens is Varsgold is talking into a communicator, and suddenly there's an explosion that rocks a ship as one of the probably last surviving Imperial Fist blows the plasma cannon that was shooting at them outside, and it goes up with the heat and light of a miniature sun. Everybody on board who survives is thrown against the bulkhead wall. The ship is now going down uncontrollably fast.
Yeah, it just blew a giant hole in the side of the ship, and it's allowing the ship to fill up both from the bottom and the top at the same time. So that it's filling in from the top means that they're essentially under the surface of the
below the waterline, yeah.
Yeah, and now they're taking on water twice as fast.
And basically, the Imperial Fist sort of set a trap. I mean, it may not have been a trap they meant to set, but they basically got them down there, and then the Imperial Fists know that they're dying. Obviously, they've lost a ton of men. They've been Phosphex bombed, but they're not going to let the Death Guard get away with it.
Right. And in a last act of heroism, the warrior in gray, even as he's melting away and dying, gets off a single shot from a bolt pistol, killing one of the destroyers.
The Sergeant Gorfon.
Sergeant Gorfon, yep.
Right under the chin, blowing the top of his head off, and then immediately gets in retribution. The chaplain kills him with a shot from his Crozius.
Crozius to the face has a very detrimental effect on somebody who's already been Phosphexed.
And
at that point, the ship lurches again, basically sinking faster and faster down into below the surface of this moon, filling with the swamp water and the foulness that is left of all the living things that were on this moon. And Murnau says, let's see, where is it? Beyond, Murnau could hear the churn of filth bubbling up beyond the flooded sections. Fetid air howled past the skinned flesh of his ears, though doing little to dislodge the cruel hold of the Phosphex that had on the deck. So basically it's sucking in air or sucking in water so fast that it's, you know, forcing the air out past him, and it doesn't do hardly anything to put out the Phosphex that's around him.
Not a cool breeze.
No. Yeah. And as the ship basically goes to the full 90 degrees as it sinks. So
two more of the destroyers die, get swept away by the water. Zorak is pretty much the only one that's with Murnau, and they're trying to climb. Murnau's using his Crozius as like a pick, like a climber would use to help himself climb back up the bulkhead, up the corridor.
Trying to get back towards the surface.
yeah, trying to get up there. But the stairwell water above and below is, you know, he's trapped. He is amused that he will become part of new life that the destruction of Hongkong has created.
Yeah, he knows he's dying. He knows that this is the end. He's trying to get out because that's what they do. I mean, the Death Guard don't give up. But he basically comes to the revelation that, you know, it's over. And now this fetid world has one more thing to feed off of, his corpse.
Yeah, for now remembers the tale of Mortarion again, and that the toxins had defeated Mortarion. But
yeah, he lied.
Had saved his son.
Yeah, he was firing them up saying, you know, Mortarion was this great guy and he you know, fought his way through and we're going to fight our way through. But that was a lie. Mortarion failed and would have died out on the slopes of Barbarus except for the Emperor. And John, give us the last two lines, please.
There would be no one to save Morgax Mornow. The chaplain remembered Forgal's insistence that there would be no survivors aboard the Xanthus. Indeed, there would be none.
That's a cool ending. It shows everybody in the right light. I mean, the Imperial Fists fought like devils on the defense, even when they were going out. They decided that they would not go out, you know, alone, that the Death Guard were coming with them. The Death Guard, you know, they died because they were so stubborn, because they could have just let the Phosphics do its work. But instead, they went down there to make sure nobody survived. And they did. They were right, but in so doing, doomed themselves.
No one survived this, the crash of this ship. Nobody that landed with the wreckage walked out of it alive, at least according to the story. I did do a little research on the name of the ship, the Xanthus.
Yeah.
And we did talk about what that name meant. There's another reference to a city called Xanthus. It's almost the same spelling, or it's got an alternate spelling that matches this. And there's a reference to it having been set siege by an army. And rather than fight the siege, the people that were in the city basically slaughtered everybody that was a, you know, woman or child, and then led a suicidal charge against the besiegers, basically destroying the city before they came out the gates. Not only did they do that once, when the city got set siege a second time, they did it again.
So they were pretty stubborn SOBs, is what you're saying.
That's right. I just thought that was a neat little historical reference that they had also built in, whether intentional or not.
Yeah.
Basically, nobody got out alive from the city, so nobody got out alive from the ship either. So.
Does Algonquis ever come up again in the Heresy story? I mean, it's just a moon. It's nothing special.
I don't think it does. I didn't find any other reference to it, so.
Yeah, I did a search for Xanthus, and I found that in the book Hands of the Emperor, that they use situation Xanthus to describe when something is happening, like it's like, you know, like red alert almost.
So it's a yellow alert.
Yeah, or gold alert.
Nice. Nice. So as far as stories go, I liked it. I remember reading it the first time and thinking, oh, that's pretty neat. I remember you know, thinking that the idea of a drum-fed bolt pistol was kind of a neat idea.
Yeah.
But at the time, I did not know what the destroyers were and what they were armed with. Rob, you want to talk about what a destroyer is in 30K?
Sure. So, Legion Destroyer Squad is 5 guys for 115 points. They have a lot of options. They can have some pretty cool upgrades. They can be up to 10-man squad. They can all take Meltabombs. They can all take jump packs. They can get missile launchers with suspensor webs and rad missiles, no other types of missiles. Rad missiles reduce the target's toughness by 1 point permanently. They can have hand flamers, plasma pistols. They can sergeants can get power weapons, power fists, lightning claws, or thunder hammers. The sergeants can have artificer armor. The sergeant may take up to 3 Phosphex bombs. That sounds very familiar. They have hardened armor. They have the counterattack special rule. Base guys have 2 bolt pistols each, so they can actually double tap bolt pistols. They're kind of gunslingers. But, you know, I thought there was a rule here. I don't see it for rad grenades. It used to be, and I guess this has changed. Oh, they do come with rad grenades. They can throw rad grenades. It used to be, I thought, if you were in contact with them, you were minus one toughness just because they're literally full of radiation themselves. I don't see that here. So they can throw rad grenades, which reduce your toughness. They can shoot rad missiles, which reduce your toughness. Nasty stuff. I mean, they're just murderous guys, and they have a pretty good battlefield role because they can take jump packs, so they can be more maneuverable. They can take Rhinos or Land Raider Proteus as dedicated transports. I think if you take Raid of Wars, you can drop them in drop pods. Yeah, it says if you use one of the special Raid of Wars, there may be other dedicated transport options available. And they are elites. They are not available as troops, except for, I believe, there is a Raid of War where you can take them as troops, or it might be Legion specific. I don't remember.
I have put together a couple of destroyers out of, you know, bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. And I've used them in a couple of games. I've never really been able to use them very well, but I know people that have. It's a neat combination that you can sometimes get to work for you between hitting them with rad to lower their toughness and then hitting the unit with an awful lot of what normally would be 50-50 chances to wound, bolt pistol, you know, strength 4, toughness 4. But if you manage to get them down one, now you're doing strength 4 versus toughness 3, and you can really rack up some wounds.
That 16% seems like a lot.
Yeah, which they can then save or not. So, but the combination of destroyers and a Moritat. So Moritats are like destroyers, but they're a little bit different. You want to talk about what those are?
I wasn't ready for that, John.
I'm sorry. Well, you can get through the magic of editing.
So Moritats are the magic of editing. So Moritats, as I open this up, are basically one-man army type guys. They walk around with either two plasma pistols or two Vulcite pistols, and they basically can just do a flurry of shots with their pistols. They basically, I think it's up to 3 extra shots per pistol. Again, I don't have the thing opened at the moment. And they basically can walk around and eliminate squads. And they are interesting in that they don't lead troops. They basically are a one-man army, go around and just guns a-blazing. But they are kind of unofficially the leaders of destroyers. Even though they can't be joined by destroyers, they kind of function very similarly. And like you said, they do work well together. They do work as a good 1-2 punch.
Yeah. So this group was led by Moritat Forgal. So he's in a leadership role for this battle group or this one frigate. Moritat Forgal, but I guess during this story, he doesn't take an actual, doesn't participate with the fight. But it's an interesting that when Rob Sanders wrote this story, he paired the Moritat with the chaplain with the destroyers. Because in the game, if you've got a Moritat and destroyers and a chaplain together, that's a really potent combination because what does the chaplain do in the game, Rob?
Chaplains, actually, they let you reroll ones in assault, or do they give you hatred? I forget now.
I think it kind of depends, but either way, anything that helps you reroll misses,
yes,
is going to help your bottom line, and so you wind up with like a multi combo punch where you hit the unit, you knock them down, their toughness. You load up on a whole bunch of bolt pistol shots, which hopefully they fail a bunch of saves. And then the guys that are left are going to be, you know, hopefully on for you, your better guys, your sergeant and maybe even a character hidden in the squad. And what's left for the Moritat to shoot at, but your sergeant and the character you've got left in your squad with his Vulcites or plasma pistols or I think the Blood Angels even get those damned little mini melta weapons, the Inferno pistols.
Yeah. All right, I've got the rule from the FAQ. All right, it says, for Legion Moritat console, when attacking with pistol weapons in the controlling player shooting phase, the Moritat may declare a chain fire attack instead of making their normal shooting attacks. While making a chain fire attack, a Moritat may roll to hit 6 times each with up to 2 pistol type weapons in the current shooting phase. So that's 12 shots with either a plasma pistol or a Vulcite pistol.
Hitting on
you
twos.
May not reroll ones. I'm sorry, you may not reroll hit rolls. Weapons which do not hit may not make chain fire attacks, which do not roll to hit. I don't know. So that, I don't know why you'd ever do that. You'd be flamer. Nerfing the guy.
You can't fire a flamer. Since the flamer doesn't roll to hit, you just place the template.
Yeah, but that would kind of ruin his whole special rule. When making a chain fire attack for weapons with the get hot or melt a special rule, roll each hit individually. If a one is rolled, stop rolling the hit for that weapon immediately. No further to hit rolls may be made with the weapon for the remainder of that phase. So using a plasma pistol is more dangerous, but man, 12 plasma pistol shots, and he is five, I believe. He's BS five, so 2+ to hit, 2+ to murder. But it is a risky if he rolls the one, then he's out. You know, he could do that on his very first shot and be like, oh, sad days.
Super Volt.
Yeah, but with a Volkite, it's less likely to kill Marines, but it's more annoying because Volkite, you know, does that, gosh, I can't think of the rule right now, but it does the D3 extra wounds in the end phase.
Yeah.
Just a little extra something to remember me by, boys.
So have you ever seen that actually work in the game?
Oh, yeah. I've been on the wrong end of a Moritat more than once. I actually don't own one yet, but I need to get some from my various legions because they're really nasty. Again, they're like a one-man army, and they can go in. They don't really scare tanks and dreadnoughts as much, but they can just murder tactical squads or heavy weapon squads or assault squads. You know, anybody with AP or with armor 3 is going to have a bad day.
I beg to differ because I had a guy drop a Blood Angel Moritat down next to a 3 Predator squadron. He dropped in right next to the one Predator, did not deviate, opened fire with his little Inferno pistols and wiped out an entire Predator squadron. Yay. Because of squadron rules, because he was within short range and he didn't miss.
I think, but that little trick is only Blood Angels. It's the only good news.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's only the Blood Angels.
Well, even plasma pistols from behind, you know, armored.
That's true. That's true. I mean, it's not impossible. It's just, right. it's not great odds. It's great. I mean, actually, I was saying they take out armor 3. Blast pistols are AP 2. They can take out Terminators if you don't roll those invuln saves.
Yep. Wow.
Going to be a bad day.
Yeah, for anybody involved.
Except the Moritat, probably. Moritat's just like, next!
Well, but I think they, what, have two wounds? Or is it 3 wounds?
I think so. I'm having a hard time finding my e-reader to open it up, because I have all my books electronically, but my iPad is right here. Let's just reach for that.
You roll those two ones, and then you fail your two saves.
Magic of editing. We can sound like we know what we're doing.
All right, so where's my books?
I'm going to cut that from here and put it right back at the beginning, through the magic of editing. Right after spoilers.
Yeah. There will be spoilers. There will be edits that make us sound way more professional than the reality.
That's going to be the new tagline right at the beginning. Yes. Right there.
Perfection.
That should be the name of the podcast. We're edited.
Heavy editing required. The downside is my iPad is just chock full of books, so I got to find the right one. Imperialis, not the right one. There we go. The Jonas Astartes. Moritat. Consoles. So many consoles. There we go, Moritat. Here we go. So one of their other special rules is that they are lone killers. They may not be taken as a compulsory HQ choice, only as an optional HQ. May never be the army's warlord. There used to be a rule in Warhammer Fantasy for the Dark Elf Assassins that they were a killer, not a leader of men, or not a leader. And that's basically what Moritats are. You know, they're a one-man assassin wrecking crew. They may not benefit from any blessing-type psychic powers or from leadership bonuses, leadership rerolls, or any other beneficial special rules provided by other friendly models or army-wide effects such as the result of a rite of war. They have one job, and that's just to go and gunslinger people down. And they do it really well. But yeah, I mean, they have the same core stats as a regular Legion console. So they're weapon skill, bliss skill 5, strength 4, tough 4, 2 wounds, initiative 5, 3 attacks, 3+ save. You can't give them Terminator armor because Terminators can't use pistols.
Can give them a jump pack, though.
Yes, you can give them a jump pack. And often, I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen a Moritat without a jump pack. because why not make them more maneuverable? They have to get in close. I mean, that is one drawback for them. They're 12-inch range. But in 12 inches, they'll kill you.
They kind of hide in the background, blend in with the destroyers until you get close enough, and then the trap is sprung.
Right.
So
cool. I think we've done a great job.
I think we could have done a lot better.
Well,
boo! Boo!
Fire this man. So now, next week, it won't be John.
I'm sorry.
Can't even get his microphone right. All right, we should close it up. Wrap it up.
All right. So you want to wrap it up since I started?
That's fine.
The magic of editing.
The magic of editing. So that was our look at Distant Echoes of Old Night by Rob Sanders. It's an old story, so people may not have caught it first go around, but it certainly holds up really well today, and I think does show exactly what kind of legion the Death Guard really are, and why we know some folks who love them dearly. Bunch of jerks.
Does give a nice little snapshot of both the Death Guard and the Imperial Fists, although it definitely is showcasing the Death Guard. And
yeah, because I don't know there's a lot of stories that really give you the Death Guard. You see Garrow a lot, but he's not your typical Death Guard.
Right.
Although he is pretty stubborn.
I'm trying to remember the stories from Isvan 3, what all we got to see of the Death Guard. I remember, who was it that Saul Tarvitz, what legion was he?
Emperor's Children.
Emperor's Children. Okay.
I can't think of anybody from the Death Guard who died. Any notables?
I thought there was a reference basically to them, you know, once the virus bomb started to land, they were, you know, some of the Death Guard were like sealing themselves into bunkers to try and weather the storm. So.
Because they knew it was coming, basically.
Yeah, they'd seen it.
Oh, they're dropping that on us. Well, then that's gonna be a problem.
So they were just gonna kill Garrow up on the ship, you know. So. The Eisenstein. That was the big name that we were worried about as a reader.
Eisenstein?
The flight of the Eisenstein?
Yeah. You're asking which Death Guard, like named Death Guard, were we, you know, were they talking about during the bombing of Istvan? And the one that they were talking about was actually Garrow. You know, he was the main one that, you know, was the named one. Like, each chapter had one or two named guys.
Or each legion had one. Sons of Horus, who got, like, a really deep roster of notable characters, but obviously the real hero of the day became Loken.
Right. He you know, you got a Yakdin, and you know, you got a couple here and there, but for the most part it was about Garrow and Saul Tarvitz, and you know one, basically almost one from each legion.
Right. Yeah. One point of view character who was on the wrong side of Istvan III.
Right.
The bombing side, if you will.
Mm.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. All right. So we know what we're going to talk about next week, but we're not going to talk about it because plans change. And we'd like to surprise our listeners, both of you out there. Hi, Mom.
Nice.
So we'll come back in about 2 weeks, and we'll drop another episode. And we hope that you'll keep listening and that we sound better to you than we do to ourselves.
Wow.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.